Today is Tuesday, January 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, no end in sight for the U.S. government shutdown that's forced some 800,000 federal employees to be furloughed or work without pay.
We're your friends and neighbors. We're being told to come to work. We don't know when we're going to be paid.
High-level talks begin on how to end a trade war between the U.S. and China. The special counsel in the Russia investigation gets a six-month extension for his grand jury. Also ahead, details on all the big winners of the Golden Globe Awards. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the Trump administration is pushing hard to portray the southern border with Mexico as an imminent humanitarian and national security crisis to win support for border wall funding in a fight with lawmakers that has brought the country to a 17-day partial government shutdown. Trump is scheduled to address the nation Tuesday about what he calls the U.S.-Mexico border crisis before traveling there on Thursday. The White House is looking into the legality of declaring a national emergency at the border to begin wall construction without congressional approval. Jeremy Mayer is an associate professor in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. His books include Running on Race, Racial Politics, and Presidential Campaigns. He joins us now to discuss. So, Jeremy, thanks for being with us. How likely is it that President Trump will declare a national security emergency?
He's a very unpredictable president. Even his most fierce supporters would admit that this is a president who listens to himself first and foremost. And in his campaign and in his first 2 years in office, he frequently made moves that were unanticipated and that experts might have advised him against. So it is entirely possible that he will announce that he's trying to do what he says is a legal maneuver under our system. He can declare a national security emergency and send troops to the border and use military funding to build this wall.
How will that go over?
Polling shows that right now that would excite some of his base. I think if it's a very convincing speech, it could move a few more people towards his base. But the polling on the wall has not budged all that much. Most Americans are for more border security. They don't like the idea that people can just walk across. But at the same time, $25 billion for a border wall that Trump promised us would be paid for by Mexico seems to be a lot to pay for if we're going to pay for it.
If we are in some sort of a crisis at the border, this wall couldn't possibly be built overnight. It would take months or even years, maybe.
It's a several-year project. And the idea that we are in a crisis on the border is, I think, ridiculous. Illegal immigration is down. And the thing that is a crisis is families traveling. So that's the scope. The numbers of families traveling with minor children is up, and that has created a crisis because of a change in policy. But what's needed is a radical increase in immigration judges. We have a 1 million case backlog, and so we have a very, very large immigration problem. That's true. But we don't have a crisis that a wall would solve.
I know the president is really talking about how this is imperative to national security, but we are hearing about, you know, TSA employees at airports calling out sick and basically getting furloughed so they are not they can't come back to work while they're not getting paid. That seems a little frightening.
So the TSA action so far seems like a wildcat strike, but you can understand why they're not reporting, because they're not getting paid. And it is a lot to ask people to do those hard jobs if they're not getting paid and no one knows when they might be paid. And I think this is a real vulnerability for Trump. As I said, they've done a pretty good job of finessing some of the costs of shutdown. But you give Americans at airports long lines that they can blame on Donald Trump, and the cost to the Republican Party will quickly get very, very high.
And then there is the question by many employees who are not considered essential and required to report to work that will ultimately get their back pay. There are hundreds of thousands of others who are just basically on furlough. They can't come to work because the government shut down. Will they get paid?
It's too soon to say. In all previous shutdowns, both the workers who were declared essential and those who got furloughs were given back pay. This time, I wouldn't be so sure. If you look at Trump's whole record, throughout his business operations, he's left behind thousands of vendors and workers who just never got paid or only got half of what they expected. The other thing is, so many norms have been violated in just the first 2 years of this presidency. The norm that we pay people even though they didn't work, I think, could come under real assault, because this Republican Party doesn't like the federal government except for the military. In fact, I think it's safe to say many of them hate it, and they hate federal workers. And Trump said, hey, these guys are Democrats. That wasn't true when he said it, but it's more true today than when he said it. And by the time this is over, if they don't get paid, it'll be hard to find a federal worker who's a Republican.
Democrats say no, they're not giving him anything for this wall. And the president says he's not backing down while hundreds of thousands of government workers are going without pay. How long could something like this go on, and what could be the consequences?
It could go on quite a long time. This is a very stubborn president, and the Democrats are also showing that they're very stubborn on this point. The other thing I think is worth noting is that, as opposed to prior shutdowns during the Clinton administration or the Obama administration, this administration is taking fairly radical steps to lessen the impact of these shutdowns. And I give you an example of what's happening in the national parks. So when Obama and Clinton were president, they shut down the national parks. Republicans said they did it because they wanted to increase the pain of the shutdown and increase pressure on the Republicans to reopen government. Democrats said they did it to protect the parks, because when you have a park that is understaffed and not safely administered, people can get hurt, as well as priceless natural resources can be damaged by trash and by abuse. Well, Trump has made a difference. A huge number of parks are remaining open. And we learned today that Vice President Pence is saying that, contrary to earlier reports, they'll even make the IRS work, that people will be getting their refunds on time. So it seems like Trump is settling in for a longer shutdown.
All right. Well, within the past 2 weeks, Democratic leadership did visit the White House twice to negotiate a deal with the president and failed. They said that weekend negotiations on border security also failed to show progress. And we thank Jeremy Mayer, associate professor in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Pro-Bashir rally as Sudan says 800 protesters have been arrested. Trump's security advisor arrives in Turkey for key talks. Netanyahu demands to confront state's witnesses in corruption probes. And a Saudi teen begs not to be sent home. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The term of the grand jury being used by U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller in his investigation of possible collusion between Russia and President Trump's 2016 election campaign has been extended. The extension is a sign that Mueller's not done presenting evidence before the grand jury in his investigation of allegations of Russian interference in the election. The grand jury was impaneled by the U.S. District Court in Washington in July of 2017 for an 18-month term, the limit under federal rules. The term can be extended if the court determines it to be in the public interest to do so. Joining us now to understand more about what the extension might mean is former CIA officer and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. So, Jack, what does it say to you that Mueller's asked for and been given another 6 months for the grand jury?
Well, the real benefit to it is it allows him to continue to operate. And I mean, in the end, that's what this is actually about. It extends his authority to continue doing exactly what it is that he does. And under those circumstances, I think it's an incredibly important thing. It also says something about the court. You know, the idea that you would actually provide this extension says something about the willingness of the court to stand up and continue to support this issue in an apolitical fashion. And that's really, really critical here.
Does it mean that the investigation is likely to go for another 6 months, or it just gives him the leeway to do that? I mean, what would your speculation be on that?
Yeah, my speculation is that generally, if you're going to do extensions, you see 6 months extension. I mean, the purpose is you shouldn't have to go back every week. You shouldn't have to go back every month. Could it go six? Sure, it could. But my expectation is, if you look at where he's going and how they are starting to focus in, I think we may be getting much closer to a conclusion here. They were always really, really pushing to sit down with the president himself, who claimed originally that he was more than willing to do so. Mm-hmm. Of course, he has backed away from that issue, and I guess he's tried to use his people as a justification. But we'll see how that plays out.
Do you think that Mueller would try to subpoena the president?
Yes, I do. In fact, I think it's possible that if he has a lot, mm-hmm. I think he's going to try to push him to testify. And potentially, what we've been seeing in the past is some of the complaints, some of the charges we have seen have enormous amounts of information, far more than that which is necessary in order to prosecute somebody. And the purpose, I think, is to get that information into the public realm and to some degree drive the president, who may be compelled to testify in some capacity or another, whether that's in person, whether that's through answering questions. And even answering questions, it's interesting because what he has to say versus what it is that the Mueller team knows mm-hmm. during this investigation is critical, and that really does open up the president still.
We're talking about the special counsel extending the grand jury for another 6 months. Can you just explain exactly what is a grand jury?
Absolutely. And there's a couple of them that were going on. There was actually the one in Virginia that was on before. And in fact, we've seen that with the Manafort case. But then there was another one going on in Washington, D.C. in that particular case as well. Essentially, what happens is a grand jury can happen in either state court or even federal court. And what you do is you bring together a group of citizens, and those citizens have the right to hear a whole bunch of information. And so what they see is all of this information. So they then come forward and they will decide on whether or not there's enough evidence to actually charge. The concept is you're trying to provide a certain amount of independence. It also really is a nod, if you will, to the belief in the American judicial system that citizens are crucial to how the system works overall. And so that really is unique, sort of even on the world stage, and something that I think we're even seeing in a case like this.
Well, Jack, now that we're in a new year and we have a new democratically controlled, Democrats controlling the House of Representatives, it looks like things may be shifting there as well on their own investigations with regarding Russia and the Russia investigation.
I think that's absolutely true. What we're seeing right now is an effort by the House Intelligence Committee actually trying to cooperate with the Mueller team and to say, look, we're going to provide all of the transcripts that came before us to you. The benefit of that is that what the Mueller team has been able to do is actually compel testimony, compel people to talk to them. If they turn around and they can actually pair what those very same people said to the House Intelligence Committee versus what they told them, if there is an inconsistency, there's potentially a federal crime for either lying to the FBI or for lying to Congress, either way. And so you literally can compare them side by side, and that fundamentally changes the power that the Mueller team actually has to actually prosecute. And we're seeing that cooperation from the House Intelligence Committee, which, by the way, there should have been in the first place, because this really should be apolitical. And if somebody's going to say something, it should be the truth. And it doesn't matter who you're talking to, whether it's the FBI, whether it's the Mueller team, whether it's justice, or whether it's Congress.
All right. Former CIA officer, currently a criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice, we appreciate your perspective. U.S.-China trade talks opened Monday in Beijing with the negotiators for the world's two biggest economies trying to resolve tariff disputes that have roiled world markets in recent weeks. U.S. Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross told CNBC the U.S. and China are likely to reach an agreement over the immediate trade issues, but that agreement on thornier disputes involving structural economic issues between the two countries could prove more difficult. Here to understand what is happening is Dr. Christine McDaniel, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. Doctor, could a deal be near, or is this just another futile effort to solve problems that are really bigger than differences, or bigger differences than can be resolved in just this short period of time?
Well, the issues that they're talking about are very big issues, and you know, however we define resolve, that will depend on, you know, how much progress you think will be made. That said, it's significant that President Trump and President Xi are both very engaged in these talks. And it's also significant that this particular time they sent, you know, their deputies and the assistant secretary level, the deputy secretary and assistant secretary levels. Those are the real, that's the level that you shows up when, you know, real engagement is on the horizon. So I'm cautiously optimistic that at the very least, a framework where that both sides, especially China, has really thought about a lot and is committed to, there will be some sort of quick, easy wins, you know, like China announcing very large purchases of U.S. soybeans and LNG and other and some energy products, things like that. But then the longer term issues, which more the structural issues, those will take longer to be realized. But if they can really start to hammer out the details now and be committed to that, then this hopefully will not all be for naught.
Trump has already put tariffs on $250 billion worth of Chinese imports into the U.S., but the two sides did agree to a 90-day ceasefire in imposing new tariffs. I believe they're up against a March 1st deadline. Would you say we would be in for even deeper trade, a deeper trade war situation or tariffs with tariffs if this doesn't get resolved?
Yes, if these talks break down, then there's a very real chance that more tariffs would be imposed. That said, I think there are incentives on both sides to make a deal in the next 60 days. I mean, look at from China's perspective. You know, their economy, you know, might be slowing down. You know, we saw the Apple results, the auto sales. The trade war is definitely hurting the Chinese economy. You know, they don't want higher tariffs. On the U.S. side, we're still humming along pretty well from the tax cuts, but that is not going to last forever. I think the Apple earnings have made people nervous. I think the market going downwards recently have spooked the White House. You know, and the administration does not want a real slowing economy going into 2020. So it's in their interest to do the hard work now and to get a good deal. So this won't be overnight, but, you know, it does look like the right people are talking to each other.
Right. It sounds like the stock market carnage certainly is pushing the president toward making a deal, because it's 2018 really ended in a very ugly way.
Yes.
Do you think if this does get resolved and turns out in a successful way, that this would promote Trump's argument that trade wars are good?
I've learned a while ago to pay less attention to what he says and more attention to what he does. That said, remember during the campaign, much of what he said during the campaign, his talk about China, his talk about trade, he has followed through on. So in that sense, we shouldn't really be surprised. Trump has a way of sort of blundering into forcing people to face the real hard questions in a real brute force way. And I think, you know, we're seeing this in foreign policy, but in terms of the trade area, we're definitely seeing it. I mean, it's not that people weren't talking about China before Trump got to office, but Trump's brute force way of basically getting ready to burn the whole thing down really has forced people to the table. I mean, look at the level of engagement that's happening, you know, between President Xi and President Trump. Look at, you know, just in the past few weeks, and we've seen some major announcements come out of the Chinese government in terms of technology and intellectual property rights. Theft. We've also seen much more engagement from the Chinese side on market access issues, joint ventures in their auto sector, market opening there. There's even talk maybe we'll see something in the health sector, financial services. So it's not as if people weren't talking about China or they weren't concerned about it. They were, but for better or worse, Trump's approach has really forced concessions to be made. So, you know, these issues have been a long time coming. To a head. Trump has just sort of gaslit them. They've always been there, but now he's really forcing people to really do something about it. As an economist, you know, I recognize that a tariff is a tax. These are, you know, have a very costly consequences, especially for American downstream industries, American manufacturers. The retaliation effects have been devastating for certain U.S. farmers. There's no easy answers here. I would have personally liked to see the U.S. stay in the Trans-Pacific Partnership and work with our like-minded allies and rein in China that way, but that's not what this administration decided to do. They decided to go a different route. You know, that said, we are now seeing these very hard talks happen. So we'll see, but I'm cautiously optimistic.
All right, Dr. Christine McDaniel, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. A leap in technology has allowed scientists to take their DNA labs out into the fields so farmers can identify diseases quickly and tackle the problem before their crops die or the virus spreads to neighboring farms. Faith Lapidus reports.
These cassava fields in Tanzania were being devastated by several viruses. This simple device from the British technology firm Oxford Nanopore can help farmers learn what is attacking their crops so they can switch to more resistant varieties.
We are here collecting leaf punches from infected material to test, to do a DNA extraction, and then start sequencing in the field.
Laura Boykin from the University of Western Australia brought the device to Asha Mohammed's farm. The testing revealed the presence of a number of viruses in the local cassava varieties and a very low viral level in resistant ones.
So what would have normally taken 6 months to a year has just happened in a couple of hours. And that's possible because of amazing technology that exists that's able to give farmers results real time.
Once the viruses were identified, Mohammed was given two types of seeds resistant to those diseases to plant. When DNA samples were collected from a pawpaw tree plantation in Kenya, the technology was able to identify the disease affecting Naomi Mumo's crop.
All my pawpaw were affected by a disease, and I didn't know what kind of disease it was. But now, I have people who've identified the disease using new technology, and within a very short time, so I'm very happy.
When the researchers returned to Mohammed's cassava farm 9 months later, the seeds had produced a bumper crop.
After 9 months of her growing the improved varieties, we are back here, and today we harvested her cassava plants, and she went from zero yield to 35 tons per hectare, which is massive.
The speed at which farmers can identify diseases can mean the difference between the success or failure of a whole area's crop, and portable real-time DNA sequencing labs are making that possible. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. For the past 50 years, the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery in Washington has been telling America's story with images of people who helped shape the history and culture of the U.S. It recently added 28 more pictures in an effort to tell a more diverse and more complete story of U.S. society. The display features well-known people like baseball player Alex Rodriguez, also known as A-Rod, and former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy. And it sheds light on some, quote, hidden figures. VOA's Julie Tabot has more.
Every year, the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery in downtown Washington adds new works to its vast collection. Anne Schumart, senior curator of photographs at the gallery, says this year's selections represent a wide range of fields.
It ranges from paintings to prints to photographs to sculpture. It's really quite a wonderful panoply of objects.
Among the exhibit's portraits is astronomer Edwin Hubble. The Hubble Space Telescope was named after him.
He was really one of the premier astronomers in the 20th century. And in the image, you see him looking through the eyepiece of a state-of-the-art telescope from 1949.
Then there's the photo of beloved children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak.
from an early age. He enjoyed reading and drawing, and that really translated ultimately into a career for him.
The exhibit also features portraits of some of the most prominent African-American figures in recent history, such as media executive Oprah Winfrey, best known for her hugely successful television program, The Oprah Winfrey Show, theater director and producer Ellen Stewart, who founded an experimental theater company, and Pulitzer Prize-winning composer George Walker, the first black to perform with the Philadelphia Orchestra back when segregation often blocked opportunities for African-Americans.
We see two images of him, one framed by his piano in his home, and the other you see his hands as he is scoring his Symphonia No. 5, which will have its world premiere next year.
There are also many Latino figures in the exhibit, says Taina Caragol, curator of painting and sculpture and Latino art and history at the gallery.
We have a wonderful color photograph by Alexis Rodriguez Huarte and Tico Torres of salsa queen Celia Cruz. We have two wonderful portraits by Harry Gamboa Jr. of Rodolfo Acuña, the father of Chicano studies, and musician Luis Perez from Los Lobos. And we also have two wonderful portraits of baseball players using the silhouette technique by Freddy Rodriguez. The players are A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, former Yankee, and Big Papi, David Ortiz from the Red Sox.
I hope that people will see figures that are familiar to them, such as Oprah, but also figures that they may not know as much about and be intrigued to learn more about that individual's biography and contribution.
These new acquisitions join more than 23,000 works in the Portrait Gallery's collection and will be on view through November of 2019. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the Queen musical Bohemian Rhapsody and the U.S. segregation-era comedy Green Book took home the top Golden Globe Award Sunday during a night of upsets. Presumed favorite A Star Is Born wound up largely shut out while Netflix won big. Eve Johnson reports.
A night of upsets at the Golden Globes on Sunday with Queen movie Bohemian Rhapsody grabbing top prize. It was a surprise victory over romance A Star Is Born, which had five nominations but clinched only one prize for Best Original Song, Shallow by Lady Gaga.
As a woman in music, it is really hard to be taken seriously as a musician and as a songwriter.
The Golden Globes kicks off the countdown to the Oscars in February. And in a break from a recent trend in awards shows, it was light on politics, with hosts Sandra Oh and Andy Samberg steering clear of controversy. Oh also walked away with Best Actress in TV Drama for her role in thriller Killing Eve.
I'd like to thank my mother and my father. Oma, Appa!
The top prize for Best Comedy or Musical went to Green Book. And in another surprise victory, Glenn Close won Best Drama Actress for her role in The Wife over presumed favorite Lady Gaga.
Spider-Man.
The upsets kept coming with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which beat out strong contenders like Incredibles 2 to win Best Animated Film. But the biggest upset of the night went to Vice. The political comedy came in with six nominations, but went home with only one prize for actor Christian Bale, who starred as former U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney. One clear winner for the night, Netflix, the streaming giant finishing with five Globe trophies, including Best Foreign Language Film for Alfonso Cuarón's Roma. And finally, the first ever Golden Globe for a lifetime career in TV was presented to comedian Carol Burnett.
Does this mean I get to accept it every year?
The new award is named after her.
That's Reuters' Eve Johnson reporting.
VOA. We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscasts, covering African news. Tune in on top of each hour, 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. www.voiceofafrica.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.